Hello, you're listening to an August 2014 podcast from the Institute for Research in Poverty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Dave Chancellor. I recently had the opportunity to talk with Sarah Halpern-Meekin, a professor in UW-Madison's School of Human Ecology. In early 2014, Halpern-Meekin and her co-author, Laura Tack of Cornell, published a paper in the Journal of Policy Analysis and Management on their qualitative study about how recipients of the Earned Income Tax Credit responded to the incentive structure of that program. To get started, let's turn to Professor Halpern-Meekin to find out how she got started on this research.
The paper is part of a larger research project that we've been doing. We started in 2007 working on this project with Kathy Eden and Jeff Kling and Ruby Mendenhall. And we did interviews. We were based in Boston, and that's what the study we're talking about today is based in, interviews with EITC, Earned Income Tax Credit recipients, in the Boston area. And there was a companion study that Professor Mendenhall was doing in Urbana-Champaign. So we interviewed Earned Income Tax Credit recipients about a whole variety of topics, and there have been a series of papers that have come out around those, and we have a book that will be coming out this fall called It's Not Like I'm Poor that gives a much more detailed portrait of families' lives and how the Earned Income Tax Credit plays a role in their lives.
The Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC as it's commonly called, is a government benefit targeted at working people with low to moderate incomes. It works through the tax system and is designed to supplement a person's earnings by reducing the tax they owe, and it's refundable, so in many cases it does lead to a refund. Although there's a small EITC benefit for people without children, the benefit available to those claiming kids as dependents can be significant, and it's more generous based on the number of kids a person has, but only up to three. It's structured so there's a phase-in period in which the credit increases as a person's income increases. It then plateaus and phases out more slowly.
So often, you know, not just with the Earned Income Tax Credit, but with social and welfare policies in general, people are concerned about what sorts of direct or indirect incentives structures may be created by the policy. Are there more benefits if you don't get married? Or are there more benefits if you have an additional child? That is, are we incentivizing people to engage in behaviors that we may not think government policy should be incentivizing people to do?
So first, Halpern-Meekin and Tack began trying to find out what people actually knew about the EITC.
Because if people are to respond to incentive structures, they need to know that they exist, or in all likelihood, they would be more influenced by them if they know they exist. So we just tried to figure out what is it that people knew first. And we found that many people knew, in general, about the EITC. They didn't really understand the structure of the benefit or the specifics. So people would know that we were talking to all people who had received the EITC, and people would know that they got part of their refund was from the EITC, and that they got it because they didn't earn a lot and because they had kids.
Well, the people they talked to were aware that the number of kids they have plays into the calculation and generosity of the EITC benefit. Halpern-Meekin and her colleagues didn't find any evidence to suggest that people are having more children to increase the size of their tax return.
When we asked, you know, how would it affect your finances? Would you have more children? People would say, oh, people who do that, people who have more children to get more in benefits. One woman said, that is not smart. You know, people understand that the costs of children far exceed the amount, you know, of an increase in your EITC benefit that you'd get at tax time. So financially, it doesn't even make sense. Yes, your benefit would increase, but the costs of having that additional child far out exceed the increase in your benefit. People also rejected the morality of that. You know, one woman told us, my children aren't money makers. So people don't see that as a good reason to have children, and not a smart reason to have children either.
Just as there's a concern that people might change their childbearing decisions to maximize the EITC, there's also a concern that EITC recipients might hold off on marriage because of the potential effect it could have on the size of their tax refund. But Halpern-Meakin says they didn't see decisions about marriage or divorce being based on the incentive structure of the EITC.
Those who were single often said, oh, marriage is the furthest thing from my mind right now. A lot of these people were single parents, and they were focused on getting by financially, on taking care of their kids. And they were saying, you know, I'm not thinking about marriage. Like, that's just not on my mind right now. So it really didn't seem to be part of the way that people were thinking about those decisions. You know, in this and other work, we did hear people talking about, well, you know, maybe we wouldn't get married if it would mean I'm no longer eligible for Medicaid, for example. You know, that's a huge impact on your day-to-day life. But we didn't hear a similar story around your tax refund.
However, they did hear people talking about changing the marital status they indicated when they filed their taxes.
We did hear stories of people saying, oh, well, I would just continue filing, you know, as head of household if I got married. That's certainly much easier than, you know, actually changing your marital status in real life. So we heard from both married and single people that they would potentially do this, file as head of household, have both spouses file as head of household, which is not legal. People didn't seem to understand that it wasn't legal. And when we heard people talk about the way that they manage finances in their household, it kind of made sense to us, this logic. Often, these single parents aren't marrying the biological parent of their children. So this marriage is happening maybe a little later on in life. So the single parent is somebody who's been running their own household for quite some time. They have their own children who aren't shared with this prospective spouse. And often people say, I'm going to keep my finances separate from my spouse anyway. And so that idea of continuing to file as head of household, even though you should be filing married, filing jointly, for example, made sense to people. I'm still head of my own household, even though I've gotten married. I still have my dependents. I still have my income. I still have my finances. And so why should we be forced to join those together by the tax code?
Deciding who claims children as dependents can have big effects in how EITC benefits are dispersed. And Halpern-Meakin reminds us that there are a lot of complicated rules about who can claim a child when it comes to taxes in general, and indeed different rules for who can claim a child for the earned income credit.
You're only able to claim children who are related to you legally, you know, in terms of marriage, or by blood. And so what that would mean is that while a step-parent can claim a stepchild for purposes of the EITC, a cohabiting partner can't claim the other partner's children. So the fact that that legal connection is absent means they can't claim them. And we see a lot of cohabitation, particularly among lower-income families. And so in that sense, again, the tax code is maybe a little out of sync with the way people are experiencing their family lives. We also see a lot of resource sharing across households. So, you know, people felt like, well, my mom helped support the kids this year. I have three kids. I'll claim two. She'll claim one. That makes sense. It depends on what the actual arrangement is there, whether or not that meets IRS rules.
Halpern-Meakin and her colleagues also looked at the extent to which people might limit their work hours and thus their income to get a bigger EITC benefit.
There doesn't seem to be strong evidence that that is going on quantitatively, and I think we can give some insight into why when we talk to people qualitatively. And one reason why is that people have relatively little control over how much they work. Often people are working in service sector jobs where their schedules vary from, you know, even from day to day, and they don't have a lot of power in affecting what their schedules will be.
As we start to think about the policy implications that we might draw from this research, one of the things that stands out is recipients' lack of knowledge about the structure of the program.
You know, somebody might hear what I'm talking about or read this study and think, well, people need to be better informed. You know, people need to understand those incentives. And, you know, I think there are, first of all, barriers to that. it's not just lower income people who don't understand the tax system. Nobody understands the tax system. You know, there's a classic study that Jeff Liebman and a colleague did around asking economists about marginal tax rates. And economists couldn't, you know, accurately report from marginal tax rates. So this is just really difficult to understand. And so I think getting people to accurately perceive incentives, there's a really high barrier there. Also, in our larger study, we see that there are some benefits to recipients of there being some vagaries around the EITC, which is that people don't tend to see it as a handout. It's not a welfare program. It's not like food stamps. It's not like public housing. It's not stigmatized. And if you get people to more accurately understand, oh, this is the part of your tax refund that's a handout, then they're maybe an increase in stigma. People might not feel so good about that. Maybe some people think that's a good thing. Maybe some people think that's a bad thing. But changing the opaqueness of the tax system could have an impact on how people perceive and emotionally experience and actually financially allocate those benefits.
Halpern Meakin says that for her, one of the big questions is how the tax code can be made to reflect the ways that people actually live their lives.
And I think getting the tax code to do that when it comes to a lot of the instability and fluctuation people have in their financial lives and in their family lives, it's very challenging. And I think that's probably the next area coming out of this study that people should be focusing on is how do we get tax policy to make sense to somebody who wants to get married and keep their finances separate, but who maybe should still be eligible for the EITC. So thinking through some of those issues, if we have two parents who are both financially contributing but not in a romantic relationship with one another, why should only one of them be able to claim a child for EITC purposes? Thinking through some of those questions that our more complex families today raise, I think, is really important.
Many thanks to Sarah Halpern Meakin for taking the time to talk about these issues with us. You've been listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research in Poverty.